Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm very happy today to be here with Alfred Young. He is the Edgar G. Epps Collegiate Professor of Sociology, Professor of Afro-American Studies, Arthur F. Thurnau Professor, and Department Chair of the Sociology Department at the University of Michigan. And he is a well-established scholar, a sociologist of African-American men especially. He is known for his books, The Minds of Marginalized Black Men, Making Sense of Mobility, Opportunity, and Future Life Chances, and Are Black Men Doomed? And today we are going to be talking about his relatively recent book from 2020, which I found great, From the Edge of the Ghetto, African Americans and the World of Work, which was published by Roman and Littlefield Press. Alfred, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Yeah. So would you start by describing your book to us?
Well, the book is actually a small project with big implications. I have spent most of my career studying the plight of Black men in large cities. And I've done so from the vantage point of being a University of Michigan professor, where I reside just west of a very small city that has a fairly robust working class and low-income African-American population. So I decided to take something of a major turn to a different geography and expand my focus to Black men and women. And what was on my mind was, what does it mean for people to live the same circumstances, conditions, issues that many of the Black men I spent the past two decades studying in large cities happen to encounter in the small city context? So the book is both an effort to talk about how space can matter in a different kind of way for African Americans who are living the same issues, concerns, questions that have been before the folks I've been saying for most of my career, but also what it meant for me to do so in an era of socioeconomic transformation, so that automation and technology, you know, what many have called the new economy, is alive and well. And it has impact for these people in ways that I really wanted to unpack and explore and write about. So both of those were at play for me: a new space, more people, and a new economic context that's shaping their lives.
And, you know, the city that you're talking about is Ypsilanti, which is, you know, in a really interesting space, right? Because it's just east of Ann Arbor, which is a wealthy white liberal college town, but really pretty close, you know, to Detroit as well. So, I mean, I guess could you expand on these particulars of this city and the ways in which it sort of interacts? And your book does such a great job of this, but the way in which sort of interact with both of these places that really loom very large in the imagination.
Yeah, and it's the imagination that means a lot, because I was struck by how these people imagine themselves, how they think that people in southeastern Michigan imagine them. And the second is much more direct. They often think of themselves as being seen as the gateway to Detroit for people that otherwise wouldn't want to have contact or exposure to that city, right? So there's a lot of mythology at this point about Detroit. I mean, we all get, I think, understand the economic transformations that have critically affected that city. But for many folks, looms large as the kind of place you wouldn't necessarily want to venture into or visit if you're not already from there. And that's an unfair depiction, but people get that. And Ypsilanti residents in large part see themselves as being regarded by others as the first step towards that city that one would want to venture into, you know, until gentrification takes over more fully. They also see themselves as less well-recognized or less well-understood because, you know, outside of southeastern Michigan, who thinks about Ypsilanti? Who's even heard of it? Who can pronounce it? Whole thing service for these people. And they're aware that they're from a place that just doesn't register in the same ways that New York, LA, Chicago might. So when they do surface in the minds of others, it's that they're the introduction to that strange, exotic place that you really shouldn't go to unless necessary. And otherwise, they're not thought about an awful lot.
And is this, you know, when you talk about the people who are, you know, the ways in which they see other people as like they're, you know, entering into this space that's uncomfortable for them. Are they primarily thinking about white Ann Arbor? You know, I mean, I'm sure there's rural areas, but I mean, I doubt they're much thinking about the farm.
Well, again, that's the neighbor, right? So their vision of privilege, success, achievement, adaptability to new economies, it's right there in Ann Arbor. Everything that the 21st century is supposed to be about is there. And so that's their connection to how the rest of the world, a more privileged world, responds to them. So, you know, the rural areas matter less, the rural areas are farther away, but the same transportation system, the boundaries are quite visible, and you know, one can cross them, you know, on a daily basis several times. So they've got immediate connection to a site of privilege and possibility that for them then creates the sense of how then they're responded to by folks in that world.
You know, I want to spend some time on this, because I think one of the great things about this book is the ways in which you get at the ways that people perceive themselves and perceive work and perceive gender. And these perceptions are so clear in your book and really fascinated me. But I think before I get there, we'll do a little bit more of like the structural sort of analysis. So the people who don't know, I personally don't know Southeast Michigan that well. I have not spent a lot of time up there. I've been, but haven't spent a lot of time. So, you know, I assume that, I guess, first of all, what is the kind of history of the economy in that region? I mean, I know you describe empty GM plants and these sorts of things, but what's that history of the economy, whether it's in the city itself or in Ann Arbor?
It is perhaps the archetypical 20th century story of the American economy. The automobile industry represented a great opportunity. It's what drove the city of Detroit. One could argue that in the first third of the 20th century, Detroit may have been the most important city in Nazi America, certainly amongst the most important two or three. And the neighborhoods, the communities around Detroit benefited, so that industry that couldn't fit in a blossoming Detroit was located ipsilanti in Cadillac, Michigan, as far away as Flint, Michigan. So those areas all became the kind of thriving suburbs for the central industry, the automobile industry, that emerged and blossomed in Detroit. And hence these other communities, Ypsilanti included, was a site for opportunity for African-Americans, for others that were leaving the South, that were leaving Southern rural regions to come to try to find success in a thriving industrial sphere. What happened in the latter half of the 20th century, the Detroit story, the decline of industry, the loss of jobs, the abandonment of people that had a means to leave, then spilled over to some of these communities. Now, of course, Ann Arbor, very well protected. The University of Michigan is there. That is not their story at all. But Ypsilanti ultimately loses employment prospects, as Detroit does. The same industries that leave Detroit ultimately leave Ypsilanti. The effect by the end of the century, though, the end of the 20th century, is that the image of Detroit looms large in the American mindset. Right, that looks to a lot of people as the industrial city that has now failed. No one's heard of the small communities around it. They suffer the same plight, the same consequences. But people don't register an image of an Ypsilanti. Maybe a Flint, because of Michael Moore's movies in the past, they did that sports. But I would bet most Americans outside of the state could name three or four smaller cities around Detroit that suffer that same fate. So that's the story. It was industry that thrived, industry now in decline, but for a set of people in a small city like Ypsilanti, invisibility, lack of recognition.
Well, and then meanwhile, you know, the stories in which we're told about the revival of these communities, or the revival of the so-called Rust Belt, seems like it would, that Ypsilanti would be perfectly set up for that, right? Because it's all supposed to be about education and healthcare and these new industries. And of course, Ypsilanti is right next to Ann Arbor. But from your book, I don't get the sense that the people of Ypsilanti exactly feel comfortable in Ann Arbor, or that the benefits from this, you know, this gigantic research institution and all the many jobs it brings is really having a positive impact on these people's lives.
Indeed. And this is where space matters in very important and in some ways understudied ways. Right? It is nearby. Again, you make the drive in a matter of minutes. In the course of this conversation, I could go from where I'm sitting right now to Ypsilanti and back. That's how close the town is. But if you don't frequent, if you don't feel a sense of cultural acceptance, there's where the challenge emerges. And for Ypsilanti residents, this sense that Ann Arbor isn't altogether inviting isn't altogether understanding, creates limited opportunities to cross boundaries, you know, say for the folks that have jobs in the university system, working class jobs, you know, lower skilled employment relative to a university professor or a physician in the healthcare system. And what it means is that even if space may seem intimate, the cultural distance looms large. And an example that I'll bring, which is closer to the part of the geography you're in, I was at Yale University, actually several days before the COVID crisis broke out in the United States of America. And I was having lunch with a graduate student in a section of New Haven. And he said, there were people in this neighborhood that couldn't tell you where Yale University is. It was just several miles away from the diner we were in. It's a graduate student who I knew from Michigan, was at Yale doing his research, studying his community. And he said, you know, it's down the road, but they just, and I said, that's the Ypsilanti story relative to the University of Michigan. It may be one exit on the interstate, a few miles on a local street. They know where it is, but they don't feel it's a part of their world. So that's the difference.
And is there any sense in Ann Arbor that this, I mean, you know, obviously your book is about the people of Ypsilanti, but is there any, you know, imaginary of Ypsilanti in Ann Arbor, or is it just like a non-entity that is irrelevant?
In two ways that are both critically detrimental for the kind of folks that I study. On the one hand, it's what I said earlier. It's seen as the gateway to Detroit. So for a lot of people, you stop at Route 23, right? Because the other side, the eastern side of Route 23 is where Ypsilanti picks up. And it's fascinating. I work out in a gym that's actually near that route. And the owner of that gym has told me that he could expand his clientele, save for the fact that they think that that gym is too close to Ypsilanti. And it scares the men off residents from coming there. Now, for other folks, and this is where gentrification can surface and where it poses problems for the kind of folks that I study, is Ypsilanti is where you go when you want a bigger house with lower taxes. And you can take over that space and make it more familiar. And that's happening on the western edge of Ypsilanti, right? The western edge of Ypsilanti is where the folks who are connected to Ann Arbor but don't want to pay Ann Arbor taxes can reside, build as they want to, still have access to the city. So it's important in those two ways, right? Both problematic for lower income African Americans.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can go back to some of this, but certainly, you know, the core of your book are the many interviews that you did, and you know, would you, I guess, talk a little bit about the interview process and just what it was like, you know, asking people these questions about their lives and their visions of work.
So it began in two ways, and it ended with my having a research team, a small team of graduate students who did a number of the interviews. But it began for me in the way a lot of projects do, which is my own experiences led me to imagine an agenda. So I used to go to Ypsilanti when I first joined the faculty of the University of Michigan to cut my hair when I had hair, you know, to find certain kinds of foods. It was a place to go to find African-American life. And I just remember talking to people about what was similar and different in my experiences as a native New Yorker who spent a long time in Chicago and then went to Michigan. And folks in Ypsilanti, the first thing that struck me is, well, where's the so-called African-American social space? You know, in New York City, there was Harlem and the Bronx and Brooklyn. In Chicago, there's the south side of Chicago, the west side of Chicago. I naively assumed Ypsilanti had that same kind of arrangement. And it really didn't, you know, there wasn't just sort of one area. And I thought, yeah, how do Black folks get along in this city? Because it doesn't seem to be a space. There might be a gym they play basketball in, but then someplace else is where they had friends. And so I began asking people just sort of, you know, what's Black social life for you here? Where do you go? What do you do? And that led me into thinking that they just navigated space very differently. And then when I met people who raised so many questions about Ann Arbor, including why someone like me would want to spend so much time in Ypsilanti, given that I was living in Ann Arbor, you know, what brought you here? Didn't they tell you stay away? You know, those kinds of things surfaced. And it made me think, in this way, it was consistent with the kind of questions I've asked in my research all along. How do folks take stock of the present situation and think about a future, given where they are? And so that's what I began asking people. So, you know, what do you hope for? What do you want? And, you know, what they wanted, what they hoped for seemed to be such a focus on what used to be And that's when I decided I had a research agenda to pursue here. I had to begin making sense of how people and asking them, you know, what's a good future for you, would give me an image that was 60 years ago in the past.
Yeah. And I mean, that to me is such a critical insight, you know, as we deal with all kinds of economic displacements, you know, in the decline of industrialization. And mm-hmm. and I just thought that part of the book was great. And so, you know, for when you ask, you know, the portion of the book, like, what does good work mean to you? Mm-hmm. What did good work mean to them?
Yeah, work with your hands. Yeah. So the kind of work I do, foreign to them. What is that about? You know, they understood teaching. They understood going to school. But walking around asking them these questions, who in the world would pay someone to do that, right? And so, you know, that's one example of work that was foreign to them. Work that made sense was precisely what the industrial order offered. You go, you get dirty, you build, you construct, you use your hands. There's something tangible you present as something I made, I did during the day, right? And thinking was just not quite in the scheme of the kind of work that made sense to them.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, a lot of the communities that I personally worked on are particularly, you know, old, you know, deindustrialized timber communities in the Northwest and mining communities in the American West. And, well, you know, especially the Northwest, these are very white communities, but the story is very similar, right? That real work is with your hands. This is what you do. And there's not really a space for us in this new economy. And, you know, and so I guess, you know, before we move on to so many of the questions I want to get to is, you know, how do you think, I mean, I realize that your questions or your research focus is a little different, but how do we get to a point where we as a society are just ignoring these traditions of work and telling people, well, I don't know, you know, go work at Walmart, go learn to code, go work in the healthcare industry. Like, why are we just ignoring these very real work traditions that exist in, you know, across race, across region, throughout the United States?
Well, I think, you know, the transformation of the American economy has positioned people to think about meaningful work in such different ways that there's been a move away from thinking about jobs that still need to be done. Work that still needs to be done, because the value now is so infused with technology and automation. Now, the COVID moment has given us an opportunity to rethink some very practical work that we need done. Folks relied upon people delivering groceries to them, stocking grocery stores in ways they might not have thought about for years, because COVID brought us a moment to think about what it means for some basic skills and services to exist. So I think there may be a moment, and in fact, I've got some work I'm involved with now here at Michigan that's trying to uncover whether that kind of work is believed by the workers who are doing it to have risen in value again. But until we unpack that, there's still a notion that the information economy, technology has set such a standard for what important work is. That the, you know, the college educated communities and the upwardly mobile just aren't thinking about certain kinds of work. And in part that was fueled by the fact that the last generation of successful workers in that sphere put their kids in colleges to go get these white collar jobs, to join the information economy, the technology economy, right? So, you know, the last moment of value for the industrial sphere was in supporting children that went to do some work other than what's in the industrial sphere. And so, you know, that further cements this notion that that work is less meaningful, less valuable, less understandable to people that never had to do it.
When you were talking to these people about work, and did the history of unions in the area, did that play much of a salient role for them?
Indeed. But again, that was tied to what made that work so well back then. But people don't immediately gravitate to a notion of the union for a grocery store clerk, or a union for someone that's behind a cashier in the local store. The union was in the plant where there were many jobs and industrial order. So all that came together in a particular kind of imagination about work. I didn't have anyone talk to me about how they thought unionization was going to save them contemporarily or matter to the kinds of opportunities they had contemporarily, right?
you talked at the beginning of our discussion about how you expanded your research focus to look at women as well in this project. And I thought, you know, one of the really fascinating things was the ways in which ideas of, quote, good work differed between men and women.
Indeed.
Talk a little bit more about that.
And that was a big lesson for me. It made me realize what it meant to have been steeped in the study of men for two decades. You know, you don't know what you don't know until you confront a new population. And when I heard these women, you know, talk about the kinds of work that they thought they could do or that was important for them, I thought, wow, you know, there's some, it was pretty evident. It didn't take it at all a critical mind to unearth that there was some gender dynamics going on here. That, you know, whether it was education or cooking or the kinds of work that just has been so classically tied to women, they imagined as what they could do and what they thought could lead to stability, if not success. And you know, it was a throwback to again, traditional work that women did, but schools were still there. And could I find my way into a school? And people need to eat, so could I sell meals? You know, I can sew clothes and people need to wear clothes. So there was a way in which they could articulate that which is still very meaningful and important and tied to what they, in some cases, were doing in informal economy, in some cases, what they were doing, you know, in traditional jobs. And for the men, you know, this vision of the information economy is just totally erasing that which they used to do. Yeah, I had some women, but not very many, that talked about women in automobile plants, right? The unspoken was that was men's work, right? The women did other things, but the men went to the plant. They built the cars. They tested the cars. They fixed the cars. And so when that economy disappears, it's the men's work that's gone. The women still felt a sense that, you know, that there was something for them. And I also think that they, without necessarily being aware of it, talked about themselves in ways that translates to a service economy. Right. Dealing with people, interacting with people. The men wanted to interact with materials, build things, right? And so the gender divide looms large. I think ultimately both have problems in a modern economy, but the women much more immediately saw themselves as being able to survive it in some ways because they could do what they were used to doing, what they could imagine women doing. And the men were just at a loss for trying to figure out where to fit in an economy that erased the kind of work that was, in all practical sense of the terms, men's work.
So, obviously, the men that you're talking about, and I think the literature shows us throughout the economy, are quite nostalgic for a past. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the women are also nostalgic, or is it more? Because I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, this work that they were doing, you know, 50, 60 years ago, that, you know, slides into a service economy more easily today, such as cooking and sewing and all of this, you know, was often unpaid labor back then, and now they might get paid for it. I mean, is there a sense of thing for women that things were better in the past as well, or is it a little different?
You know, I'm not so sure they thought it was much better, but they just saw a more continuity between the past and the present.
No.
So, you know, what was better is that the men in their lives, whether they were partners or neighbors or children or relatives, were working in the plant. So more people had work. That was definitely better. They just saw what they were doing as what they had done in the past, what allowed them to survive in some way, whether it was doing that work for their families, consisted of men that went to work, or now doing it for themselves and getting some wages from that. So the work was meaningful, maybe in different ways over time, but it's what they knew how to do, what they believed in, what they thought they could continue to do to survive.
Another, you know, big piece that comes out of your interviews is the work ethic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, could you talk about the ways in which people articulate their own work ethic and kind of maybe some of the bigger findings you had out of that?
Yeah. And then, you know, I think there's a huge debate nationally, a huge debate historically about what work ethic means. It is one of the most politically charged terms because it's so easy for those of us that have achieved success in the modern economy to say that those that haven't, well, it's the work ethic. Work means different things to different people, right? And in industry and on that site, the notion was you work hard, you get dirty. But there's respect, there's acknowledgement of what you do there. And if you're in work environments that lack that kind of respect, lack that kind of acknowledgement, You say, is this work worth it? And that's where, for this population, particularly the men, the challenge of the work ethic unfolds. People say, well, they don't want to do any work. What's wrong with them? They want work that garners respect. And for some men, they'll find ways to survive materially without that kind of work. So if the respect, or listen, you know, I don't mean respect in terms of this extreme deference to them, but just acknowledge that what they do is meaningful. If that doesn't come with work, then the question is, how do I survive? And people find various ways to survive. The informal economy, the illicit economy, you know, other means. And so that's what's at stake, is the work ethic erases some critical considerations. You know, Roy seems to be talking about in this conversation of whether people recognize work as meaningful and whether they accord people some sense of acknowledgement that work is meaningful. And in the most direct way, it's about wages. The very work that these folks are doing today doesn't garner nearly as much as it did even 50 years ago, working in a grocery store, moving boxes, stocking shelves. The income doesn't allow an individual to support him or herself or a family. So that's the strong statement, that that work is not respected. And so if you can survive other ways, why do it? I think we need to invest more fully in understanding of how people think about work and what they want from work, wages being important, but some other things too, to better understand how people approach what they do and why they may not approach it in some certain ways.
Well, and I think that, I mean, I could not agree with you more. And I think that in a lot of the broader conversations about the economy, you know, I feel like our policymakers, but also some academics and certainly writers, are often sort of looking at this from 30,000 feet and saying, oh, this is good and this is, you know, less productive or whatever, without getting into the understanding of what do people actually want, right? Because whatever policies you're going to put in are going to be interpreted and shaped by the people who are actually doing this or not doing it. And it really drives me crazy. So I guess as a last question, I know you're super busy and I don't want to keep you too long. What are some takeaways from this book that we can use to rethink ideas of work and race in America?
Several. And some of the takeaways are for people that are in more elite spaces. Some are takeaways from people that are struggling to survive our modern times. As far as elites, the more privileged go, a real understanding that there is value in some of the work that we don't pay people enough for, that we don't allow them to unionize around. I mean, again, the COVID moment has brought this, you know, fully before us, right? Anyone that's had a package delivered from Amazon should understand that there are workers in plants, workers driving vehicles that are getting materials to you that you value. And those very workers right now are struggling for salaries, for respect, for secure work environments, right? The ability to survive COVID. So we see that now. The question is, will we act upon it? But so much of this work is now clear to many people as being of value. The pizza delivery person mattered during COVID more than perhaps they have in decades, because it meant you've got food in a comfortable environment in your home. And I would hope that there is a better discussion amongst the privileged about how much that work is of value to the rest of us, so that we can value the people that do it. It means better wages. It means working conditions that are more comfortable. It means acknowledging what they do and not function in a context of displacement and replacement of workers around that sphere. For the workers themselves, a different kind of project at hand. I think there is much more for people to learn about what the modern economy offers and how to manage it. I am struck by, and I don't blame people for this, because their history has positioned them as they've been positioned. But in Ypsilanti, in Southeastern Michigan more generally, when discussions of the green economy have surfaced, so many people have responded to me in these conversations, to others, with, well, that sounds like the kind of work my grandfather did in Mississippi, sharecropping work, modernized slavery, right? When you talk about agriculture and green, that kinds of an image of oppression in the South decades ago. And that is not the green economy as we know it to be, those of us who are in a different position. but you got to appreciate and understand how people come to understand modern work on the basis of what their families did in the past, what pain and trauma that caused. And so there are some efforts that's got to be put in play to help people understand economies. Same thing around information technology. I continue to explore how people in the communities like Ypsilanti understand technology, what it can and what it cannot do. And they're not environments where they get that, right? They've got cell phones, they've got computers at home, but what does it mean for information to transfer in the ways that it does? What's valid information, invalid information? How do elites manage that information that's different than people on the ground might? That's beyond some of these folks, many of these folks. And so understanding that aspect of the new economy, there's so much to the modern economy that is beyond what people who believe in the factory and knew mom and dad benefited from, because they got away from that sharecropping work in the South, right? Still hold on to that, that prevents a deeper understanding of possibilities, opportunities, even imagining oneself in the new economy. So there's lessons on both ends of the divide, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Al, I want to thank you so much for this. This was really great. We've been talking to Alfred Young about his fantastic book from 2020, From the Edge of the Ghetto, African Americans and the World of Work. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,